Look, it's great to be together and conscious that it's a long weekend, and for many of you, you wanted to go away, but you deliberately came here to church tonight, and that's fantastic. Especially just want to encourage you, if you've come tonight as someone who doesn't normally come to church, I just want to sort of respect, you know, like it's just fantastic that you want to consider these things, wrestle with these things. I hope it's helpful. There will be questions at the end of tonight, and you'll see the phone number down there. Whose phone number is it? It's Adrian. Okay, so it's still Adrian. All right, so make sure as you go through, if there's stuff that you kind of want to pursue further, we'll be able to have some time into that later. Now, let me kick off, though, by introducing this topic, a hugely important topic about suffering, by looking at a short video of a man called Stephen Fry. He's a British man who's in various TV shows and... He's a comedian. I mean, I enjoy looking at Stephen Fry. He's a very funny man, but a very clever man. But this is quite a disturbing video, but it helps us get into the topic. So listen in. Watch this.
And you walk up to the pearly gates and you are confronted by God. What will Stephen Fry say to him, her, or it?
Basically, the opposite. I think I'm saying to both the parents and children, what's that about? How dare you create the world? Such misery is not our fault. It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain? That's what I say.
Do you think you're going to get in?
No, right. But I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to get in on his terms. They're wrong. Now, if I died and it was good to pay this.
That'll do us. It just gets worse as it goes along. There's a quite powerful introduction to the whole question of suffering tonight, in that there's a man who has rejected the whole notion of God on the basis of his seeing suffering around the place. And do you see the passion? Did you feel the energy from him? I'm going to come back to it shortly. And it puts it in its starkest form. For him, it throws all back on God. Utterly, utterly evil, stupid, capricious. I'm not going to believe in a God that's so ugly as you are, and so on. Now, among us today, there will be some in that same place. For some people, this is a topic that's not just armchair. It's not just, sit back and troll through the internet and throw some stuff out, you know, online. This, for you, you're actually in the midst of it. You've seen suffering happen. You've got things going on in your family life. You've got things going amongst your friends and so on. You yourself might be suffering, and you're going, where is God? Why is he doing this? There's a real energy for you in this. And in the outset, I want to offer that it's actually quite hard to deal with this topic in a large crowd, because everyone is in different places. Some of you had that raw emotion. You're going through it at the moment. Others of you, for you, it is just an intellectual exercise. You are puzzled about this. You wonder about this. You've decided on the basis of this, perhaps you're going to throw the idea of God out. Now, how do we deal with both those groups of people together? I am going to attempt to do both. I'm going to deal, firstly, with the intellectual issues. It's important that we do. Now, that won't help you if you're in a hospital room right at the moment. You know, like there's a other different conversation that needs to happen. And I want to touch on some of that at the end. I want to come to how to engage together at that kind of more heart level. But the intellectual thing is important, because there is an intellectual problem here. There's an issue that we need to think into, particularly to be prepared for the future. And so I'm going to go down that path as well. Now, at the beginning, though, let me outline my first point, which is to come clean and say, I don't have all the answers. Ultimately, I don't know the answer. Or perhaps to put it another way, I don't know the details of the answer. Now, I don't know if that's a help or a disappointment. It might be a help for you in that you kind of finally they've come clean, those Christians. Or it might be a disappointment in that you're actually wanting to get the answers and looking forward to getting them. But here's the deal. Here's what I want to do tonight. I want to go in three big steps. I want to show you that I don't have the answers because the Bible doesn't give them to us. But secondly, I want to say no one has the answers anywhere in the world. And I'm going to go that with us. And third, though, I want to say there are still some things that can be said. And the Bible gives us the best things you can say about this topic that are hugely helpful and life-changing and life-giving. So stick into the end. Let me start with that first point. I don't have the answers. The Bible's not given us the answers. Therefore, the key to the topic, the big thing tonight is humility. Humility. That is the key. And to get this kind of reinforced, let me consider a couple of passages, one of the most important ones, firstly in Luke chapter 13 on this topic. It wasn't read for us. Josie read the second passage I'll look at, but if you've got your Bibles, grab it there. And if you're given something as you came in, you might even have that in your hand. Luke chapter 13, it's a passage that talks, that records for us an incident where some people came to Jesus to ask him about the question of suffering. So this is right on topic. And in chapter 13, there it is up on the screen, there was some present at that time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. Now, the incident that is being talked about here was an episode that happened back in the ancient world. You know the Bible's dealing with history. Back in the ancient world, where some people in the northern parts of Palestine, Galilee, came down to Jerusalem to the temple to offer sacrifices, God-honoring, sincere, committed to doing this. And at the moment they did that, the ruler of the time, Pilate, actually had them slaughtered and had their blood mixed in with the sacrifices into the temple. It's an atrocious evil that was perpetrated by this man, Pilate. And the question that was asked was to Jesus, did this horrendous suffering happen to them because they were more sinful than the rest of us? Like, why did it happen to them and not to us? Is it because they were more sinful? And Jesus says no, but unless you repent, you too will all perish. Come to the next slide, or go further down in your text. He mentions, these people mention another episode where 18 died when the Tower of Siloam fell on them. Again, another incident in the ancient world. Do you think they were more guilty than all the others living in Jerusalem? I tell you no, but unless you repent, you too will all perish. What I want you to notice here is that this is a non-answer. It's a non-answer. They've come saying kind of, why did these people suffer? Was it because they're more guilty than the rest of us? And Jesus says, no, that's not the answer. And then doesn't give the answer. He doesn't actually say, oh, here's why it happened. He just turns to them and says, you better get your act together. It's a non-answer. The Bible doesn't give us the answer at this point. This is of a piece with an earlier passage, the one that Josie did read to us from the book of Job, which is also a non-answer. And again, if you've got your Bibles, it'll probably come up on the screen there, but come back to Job 38. The book of Job is a book all about suffering. A man in the ancient world, Job, long time before Jesus in terms of history, went through atrocious suffering. He lost his family, all his kids were killed. Then he lost his house, his property, his business, his health. Apparently his wife was left with him and she was a nagger, so that was piece of the suffering. But it just went on and on and on for him. And the book kind of records not only what happened, but also how a group of religious leaders got alongside him and began to counsel him about why this had happened. Why did suffering happen in your life? Well, they began to give him the answers. And they said it was because of sin and judgment. It's because you must have sinned greatly, because God, the just God, would only punish, bring suffering if you've sinned greatly. And so they went on and on explaining this to Job. At the end of the book describes God finally speaking into the situation. And have a look at chapter 42, or listen to it as I read. Verse 7, God says, I'm angry with you and your two friends, the counselors, the religious leaders, because you have not spoken the truth about me. This didn't happen because of sin and judgment. You're wrong. And then God addresses Job relentlessly. Come back to chapter 38 and questions him. Read this with me. Listen to as I read. Who is it that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man and I will question you and you will listen to me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? Who laid its cornerstone while the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? Who shut up the seas behind the doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds in garments and wrapped it and so on. Do you see him question after question after question? You come down to verse 21, surely you know, for you are already born, you have lived so many years. This is a powerful expression of God saying to a man, you're just a man. You don't know stuff. You are limited. It's a passage that effectively says to Job, learn to know who you are. I don't know if you've heard that around in contemporary setting at the moment. It's a very big thing to know who you are, to be kind of deep aware of who you are. This is God saying, you want to know who you are? You need to know this profound truth about yourself, that you are limited, you are a creature, you're finite, you don't know much, you have huge gaps in your understandings of things because you've been alive for a moment in the existence of the whole universe. In the vastness of the whole thing, you're a small, tiny speck. Know this about yourself, Job. Wake up to yourself. Stop acting as if you can stand in judgment on me, says God. What do you actually know to be able to pass that judgment? This will be, of course, God's response to Stephen Fry. Stephen Fry's kind of seen some things in life that he doesn't like, which none of us like, but he's joined some dots and made some conclusions about, therefore, what God must be like. And he will one day, like all of us, will stand before God and God will say, you brace yourself like a man. Where were you when I made all of this? Who do you think you are? You're a mere creature. In all of this, here's the key thing. God never tells Job why he did it. He never tells Job why he... Now, he tells us, the book tells us at the very start of the book, and it had nothing to do with sin and judgment. It had all to do with God's glory and a whole different thing going on. But Job had no clue and God didn't tell him. Because much of what happens in our experience of suffering, we don't have the answers to. You know, this is hard to hear, but why did God not give Job the answer? Why didn't Jesus give the answer? Why did they suffer the way they did? I'll tell you why. Because there are bigger things going on in the universe than us. The world doesn't revolve around us. God doesn't owe us an answer. Learn to know who you are. You're a creature under the God of the universe. That cuts across our pride because we want to think, last week we talked about this, we want to think we're at the center and if he was there, he owes us things. No, he doesn't. Take great care. Be humble before this God. You know, I find this a series a challenge, just the heading of it, questions for God and the signpost out the front. Not that, I mean, I was part of us deciding to put the signpost out there, so there's no critique of anyone, but every time I drive past it, I kind of have this start. I kind of go, oh, because just the language of questions for God sounds pretentious of us humans. That we're going to put God in the dock and pester him with our questions that he has to answer and justify himself. Wow, who do we think we are? Take great care. It's not wrong to ask questions of God. It's just the spirit of the questioning matters massively. Humility. Why suffering? Why has God allowed suffering in our world? A good question to ask. Ask it with great humility, aware of how limited we are. And as I say, the Bible doesn't give us all the details of the answer. Doesn't explain why each of us will have suffering in the different contexts. Doesn't give all the answers. But here's the deal. We don't have all the answers, and neither does anyone else. This is really important, and I'm going to spend a chunk of time on this second section. I want to show you the kinds of answers that people often give for the question of suffering, why suffering, and how they actually don't cut it. They don't give us a satisfactory answer. And I'm doing that to kind of clear the ground because I've said the Christian faith, the Bible doesn't give us all the answers. And I don't want you to kind of fall into the trap of imagining, therefore, the Christian faith's inadequate because it can't give us the answers to this question. What I'm saying to you is it doesn't, and nowhere else has them. So you don't go, it hasn't got the answers, therefore how good we are. No, none of us have the answers anywhere. And so this part of it's very important. I'm very briefly going to show you how other religions answer the question and then how the irreligious answer it. You can see the sections I'm going to run through there. Let me first look at Hinduism. Every religion is trying to wrestle with the question of suffering. Why is there suffering? Why is the divine or the power or God allowed suffering? Hinduism, its answer, and this is very brief and very inadequate, but it'll give you a quick taste of it. Hinduism answers the question by effectively saying that it's man-made. Every bit of suffering can be explained by humankind and our behaviour. So suffering, says Hinduism, is what you earn or attract to yourself by a thing called karma. It's your karma. And your karma is affected by your behaviour in this life or the life, previous lives before. So that if terrible things happen to you, if evil happens to you, if you're born an untouchable in the lowest caste and you're left destitute on the street, a beggar, well, that's happened to you because you deserved it. Your life attracted that because of your karma, your behaviour. And if another person's kind of living in luxury in the palace and having a wonderful life with servants, their life is that because they attracted good. That's their life actually earned that in a sense. Now, that's the answer. It's a comprehensive answer. It answers it completely. Why is suffering? It tells you exactly why every bit of suffering happens because of something in your life. But here's the problem with it. It creates a world in which it's very hard to ever be compassionate for anyone. Because when I walk past the beggar in the street, you know, paralyzed, withered limbs, no food, completely starving and flies around and they're I look at them and I say, I don't have compassion so much as, gee, you must have done something terrible to earn that. And actually, you need to live through that because that's how you balance the powers of the universe. That's your lot. Now, I might still show some compassion because that's the way I'll attract more karma to myself. Yeah, there's the nature of the consequences of these things, which I want to offer are not adequate as a way of understanding humankind together. Buddhism. Buddhism began in the context of suffering. The man that we now call the Buddha was himself a very wealthy in the Hindu kind of world, and he went outside his palace and saw great suffering, and it caused him to have to stop and reflect, what is going on in life? Why is there suffering? And he spent a great deal of time reflecting on that until enlightenment came. And his conclusion, kind of in large, very simplistic terms, his conclusion was, suffering happens because of attachment. The reason I suffer when something's taken from me is because I like it too much. I love it too much. I want it too much. I'm attached. So if a loved one dies, then my suffering comes because I love them too much. And couldn't, you know, I'm attached to them. And I need to let go of all attachments so that whatever happens doesn't touch me. I'm untouched. And so suffering is removed. Now again, it's a comprehensive answer, but unlivable. There's a beautiful Buddhist poem written about 200 years ago by a young man, Kobayashi Isa, who lost his mother, then his father. He married and had for a brief time something wonderful, but then his firstborn died, and then his next child died, and then his wife died, and he lived in terrible grief and pain. And he wrote this poem as a kind of, he was a lay Buddhist monk. He wrote this poem that goes like this. This is a translation of it, not by me, of course, but this is a translation into English of the poem. The world is due. Is the world of Jew, and yet, the world of Jew is a world of Jew, and yet. And in the poem, he's effectively presenting the dogma of the Buddhist world, which the world of Jew is the world of Jew. It's just Jew, of no account, intransient, impermanent, just goes. Nothing to be attached to. It's of a nothing. And yet. And there's a sense in which he's living with this tension between that's what I know should be true, that there's nothing in the world that I should be attached to, that it all should just be gone, it's a nothing. But I loved my wife. I loved my child. And I feel torn by the dogma I'm told to believe, and yet the experience of my life, very hard to live it. Let me give you Islam's answer. Its answer is that all suffering is entirely the will of God. The great power God makes things happen, makes everything happen, and your role as someone living in this world is to submit to whatever happens. That's where the word Islam and Muslim comes from, the root to submit. To submit. That's the essence of being a Muslim, is to submit to the power of God, to the actions of God, to the brute fact and force of the sovereign power, that he does whatever he does and you submit. Now, those, of course, who are in Islam are best able to answer what it does for culture and community, but I would offer this observation, correct me if I'm wrong, but many do sense that it creates fatalism. Just what is, what is. And my role is not to fight against it, it's not to seek to make a way through, it's just to submit. I again would offer that it creates a community culture of life that doesn't engage full humanity. All religions wrestle with the question, I'm suggesting inadequately, but so do the irreligious. The irreligious wrestle with the question. So consider with me the atheist. Consider with me the atheist. We're often given the impression in our society, and many of you may feel this, I'm going to spend a bit longer on this one, given the impression that suffering is just a problem for those who believe in God, and the way to solve the problem of suffering is to get rid of the notion of God, this is Stephen Fry, get rid of the notion of God and live without God, and then you've resolved the problem of suffering. That's the impression given. And it goes like this, there's a kind of philosophical syllogism that's delivered by the atheist, and it offers this kind of shape to it. If God is all-powerful and all-loving, he wouldn't allow suffering. The fact that there is suffering means that he can't be either all-powerful or all-loving, because if he was all-powerful, he'd stop it. If he was all-loving, he'd want to stop it. So if there is suffering, it's because he can't stop it or because he doesn't want to stop it. So if there's a God, he can't be all-powerful or all-loving, or he isn't there at all. So the most famous atheist, although is he still calling himself an atheist, Richard Dawkins, says this, the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. So Richard Dawkins, at least at that point, is very honest in the sense that if there is no God, then what we have, what our existence is random chance. There is no purpose, there's no meaning, there's no right, there's no wrong, there's no evil, there's no good, there's no design. It's just random, and we're living in this random thing where some of you cop it, others don't. It's just random, there's no meaning to it, there's no question to be answered. Why suffering? Because you're living in a world which is random. Now, there's two problems with this solution to the question of suffering. The first one is it's self-defeating. The outrage that the atheist has over suffering, which is the reason they cast off God, defeats the solution they create. So Stephen Fry, did you notice Stephen Fry, did you notice his moral indignation? He wasn't just coolly saying it makes no rational sense that there's a God who's all powerful. He's actually going, it's utterly, utterly evil, he says, that such a God should behave that way. He uses categories, get this, he uses categories that are only possible to have if there is a God. Evil. If there is no God, there is no such thing as evil. It doesn't exist. Evil is a moral category that can only exist if you have a supernatural power that actually creates principles and truths and right and wrongs that are over us. But if all we are is nature, then nature, the essence of the natural life, is survival of the fittest. The essence of nature is that the powerful survive, the weak get eaten. And there's nothing right or wrong about that. That just is. Well, if you believe there's no God, then you're compelled to actually hold the view that actually there is no right and wrong. There's nothing evil. It's just what is. So if someone suffers and someone doesn't, then you don't have outrage over it. You just go, that's what is. Now, here's the deal. You can't have your cake and eat it too. If you're going to keep the outrage at God for allowing these evil things, you have to keep God or drop your outrage. Do you see? You can't continue to be outraged if the universe is a universe without God, because there's nothing to be outraged about. It just is. So if you want to be outraged, you've got to keep believing in God. But if you want to get rid of God, drop all your outrage. So it becomes self-defeating. But more, there's a logical problem with it as well, which has now been addressed by a recent philosophical thought by a man called Alvin Plantinga. And I want to show you this. Alvin Plantinga is a philosopher of some note. He's written a book called Good Freedom and Evil, and a previous papers earlier than that, and some years ago now. But look at the next slide here. It'll give you some sense of this man. A classic work, but look at the end. The single most influential text on the problem of evil in the past 50 years. A very significant work. And many people now regard that this has dealt with the issue in large measure. And Alvin Plantinga's basic thesis is that an all-good and all-powerful God may allow suffering if there was a good reason for it. Let me just say that again. That logically, it's entirely philosophically acceptable to believe in an all-powerful, all-loving God and the existence of evil if there's a good reason for an all-powerful, all-loving God to allow suffering. That's his basic thesis. Now, he doesn't say he's come up with that reason. He offers one in his materials. But his point is that the key thought is it's logically possible for an all-powerful, all-loving God to allow evil if there's a good reason for it. And the illustration I'd offer for this is vaccination. I don't know if you've been vaccinated. I assume you have. Most of us have, and most of us committed to it. The vaccination is a terribly painful thing to put a young infant through, and many parents balk at it, but you know what? A mother who loves their child puts their pain through great grief and anguish as they get immunized. Why? Why does a parent do that who loves their child? Put them through such suffering. Why? So they don't get sick. Which is to say, they're prepared to put the one they love as the all-powerful parent through suffering because they believe there's a good reason for it. They believe there's something good that will come out of the suffering, or that is the only way to get to the good outcome is through the path of suffering. And so all-powerful, all-loving parents are quite appropriately able to take a child through suffering because of the good outcome that's necessary for it. Now, that's the point that Plantinga is making. That's the point. Now, you might respond by saying, I cannot conceive of any good reason that would justify all the suffering that we see in our world. I can't imagine any reason why a God could see something good come through all of this. But you know what that tells us? You haven't got a very good imagination. What it tells us simply is that you're a human who's limited and needs to bring some humility to the exercise, because that we can't think of a good reason or a reason that seems good enough to us to justify all the suffering doesn't mean there can't be that reason. Doesn't mean it's not possible to have a reason, it just means we're not able to think of one. And so his work has been massively influential, such that this comment from William Lane Craig, some of you will have known William Lane Craig, "Therefore, I'm very pleased to be able to report that it's widely agreed among contemporary philosophers that the logical problem of evil has been dissolved. The coexistence of God and evil is logically possible." I understand, I'm not pleased. You know I'm not an expert in this area, but I understand that, you know, at the kind of high levels, this is the way people are now appreciating and thinking, and it's starting to percolate back out, but you won't see it out into popular thought for many years yet. The point is that I'm making in all of this, when you look at everybody else and their attempt to come up with answers to why suffering, none of them work. Other religions don't have the answers. The irreligious, the atheist, has a very inadequate answer. It only makes sense at a superficial level. When you push it and prod it and nodge it, it falls apart. The point? The world is complex. It's beyond us. The most important point is to bring humility to this exercise. Now, does the Christian faith, thirdly, have anything to say? Yes. Not in all detail, not kind of with every piece sorted out, but some very important things are drawn by the scriptures that are most critical that we embrace and make most sense and are actually life-changing. Come with me to Jesus' words again, Luke chapter 13. We'll come back and forward with the screen. Thanks, yeah. When you come back to chapter 13 again and Jesus engaging with this topic, the first thing I want to draw attention to is that what this text shows you is that God is sovereign over tragedy, but it ought not be the first place you go. Let me repeat that. What this helps you see is that God is sovereign over tragedy and suffering. Never lets go of that. But it's not the first place you go. These people come to Jesus and ask the question, why did this suffering happen? Did it happen because they're more sinful than anyone else? So in that, they recognize God is in it. They assume that it's a judgment of God, that God is sovereign over it in some fashion, which we'll come back to. But the foreground thing for them was it was judgment on sin. The foreground thing was that it was a judgment deserved by people. Their question isn't, how come innocent people suffer? How could God do such a terrible thing? That's not their question. Their question is, if this happened, it must be because there was sin involved in some fashion. These people must have deserved it as sinners worse than others. Now, it's hugely important to see this. And putting aside the question at this moment of whether God was sovereign over it, whether he allowed it or decreed it or willed it, putting that aside for the moment, much of human suffering is the fault of humans. Much of human suffering is the fault of humans. In particular and in general. Let me explain. In particular, Pilate was the one who killed those worshippers. It was a human who did it. I'll give you some other examples though. A young child who was run over by a car and left paralyzed for the rest of their lives with all the impact on the family and the extended and the future and the terrible suffering that comes from that, because an idiot came out of the pub and instead of walking home, got behind his wheel drunk and drove off. And you say, why has God allowed such terrible suffering? Your first response ought to be, why are people such idiots? Why is there such selfishness in our world? That ought to be the first thing you come to. You know, thousands of homes are washed away in a landslide because a profit-hungry business cuts corners and ignores the geology reports about that particular place just to throw up quick houses to sell to make a buck and run away. And the people who end up living there, the only ones who could afford to live there, they're poor people. And so it gets filled with poor people. Then the geology collapses, as it was always going to. And the answer, the question ought not to be, how can God allow such? The question would be, what is wrong with humans? That humanity would be so consumed with its own greed and its opportunities that it doesn't care. What is wrong with us? That's the first thing you should consider. You know, millions around our world over the years have died of starvation through famine. But here's the deal. We have enough food across the planet to feed everybody. And we've got the capacity to get it where it needs to be. Why do they still starve? It's not because there's a drought. It's because of indifference in humankind, greed, selfishness, political power games of the rulers of various countries who might get aid come and be delivered to their docks but won't deliver it and distribute it because they're using it as a power game. When you hear of famine, your first response ought to be, what is wrong with us that we can't fix this? Do you know, millions of babies are killed every year in the womb. And we have just had a ruling in New York that says you can now kill a baby up until birth. Untold suffering. Now, just let me say, there's forgiveness if you have gone down that path. But what is wrong with, it's not, where is God? It's, what is wrong with us? That we think a person's choice is more, that they're free to choose is more important than the life of a weak and unprotected infant. What is wrong with us? Vast amounts of suffering are us, and we need to own it. It's us in particular, but it's us in general. Why is the world like this? Why is there cancer that comes? Why is the world a place where hurricane and storm destroy? Why is that like it? Well, the Bible's answer is because of sin and judgment upon it. The answer of the first chapters of the Bible is that God made the world beautiful. He made it a paradise. The pride of our first parents and their rebellion against a good and loving God broke the world. It took it into a fall, or pushed it into a fall. And it broke not just their relationship between themselves and their God, it broke their relationship with each other. Fear came in. It broke their relationship to creation and nature. Now the world around us fights against us. And now what should be natural in birth is actually a painful, and death has now come in because God has actually put a limit on our sin and our horror. He responded rightly by judging us. This is huge and painful and something we struggle to face. Why does God allow terrible things to happen? The question ought not be that first. It ought to be, what's wrong with us? What have we done to our world? That's where the questions ought to start. And did you notice that Jesus does something quite deep here in chapter 13? Jesus is not, you know, Jesus meek and mild is a complete fabrication. Jesus was scary to hang out with. Because you'd bring your agenda, he'd change it completely. Look what he does in chapter 13. We've got it back up there. Yep. Do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered this way? I tell you, no, you've got it wrong. Their suffering wasn't because of sin and judgment simply. But then he doesn't say what it was about. He says, but unless you repent, you too will suffer. You'll perish unless you repent. He turns straight on the questioners. And here's what he does. I tell you, they suffered like that not because they're worse than you. They're not worse than you. You're just as bad. Your question ought not to be, were they worse that God judged them? But why hasn't he judged you yet? Do you see the profound difference he's just done for them and for us? There's an assumption amongst us about innocence. There's an assumption amongst, in our society particularly, that we're kind of basically good people, and if anything bad happens to us, it must be God, terrible God. We live with this notion that we're basically good people and so deserve all this wonderful thing from God. And if he doesn't give us the one, if he brings suffering into our life, then what is wrong with that God? But the Bible starts with a very different presupposition, a very different assumption. Jesus operates with a profoundly different way of thinking. He operates with the paradigm, which is all through the Bible, that humans are not basically good, but they're actually basically selfish. Humans are born in sin. Humans are basically turned in on themselves, with ourselves at the center, pushing everyone else out. We're about ourselves. We're basically broken. We're able to do good things, but then gravity draws us back to ourselves. That's the assumption the Bible starts with, which means it's astonished that any of us should get away with not suffering. Do you know, in theological circles, there's this little phrase that's a beautiful phrase, the misplaced locus of amazement. How good is that? The misplaced locus of amazement. And it simply means this, that we are amazed about some things, but we've misplaced the point of amazement. We should be amazed about something else. The misplaced locus of amazement. We begin with a sense that we're owed something, and Jesus turns it on its head and says, you ought to be not amazed that they should have suffered like that. You should be amazed that you haven't yet suffered. The question isn't why did they suffer, but why do you enjoy peace? Why have you not been punished yet? Why are you enjoying health and comfort? We do feel like we're owed a long life by God when the Bible is astonished that any of us make it past a few years. It's the grace of God that we should actually live for another day. Why does God allow suffering? Well, the foreground thing is human sin and God's judgment. And the question, therefore, that should be ours is why are we not seeing more suffering? Because we are all sinners. People talk about this topic as if it's called the problem of suffering. There is a problem in our world, but it's not the problem of suffering so much, though there is. I want to acknowledge there is. But it's not the problem of suffering so much as the problem of pleasure. Why do we have any pleasure, given who we are and given how we've been before God and with each other? Why is there any peace at all? Now, please, I'm not saying this answers all the questions, but we won't understand the reality of our lives without paying attention to this massively important truth about ourselves, what we bring, how we have been party to destroying the world, how we've actually been responsible in particulars and in general to the way the world is like it is. Jesus says, were they worse sinners? I tell you, no. It's kind of like, what do you mean? Worse than you? No, they're no worse than you. Which therefore means the fact that it's not happened to you yet ought to make you deeply, deeply concerned to repent as quickly as you can. Because if it happened to them who are the same as you, it will happen to you. Repent. And here is another purpose for suffering that's alluded to, which is the megaphone idea. It's the idea that God in his kindness uses suffering to shout out to us and our world and say there's something deeply wrong with you. There's something wrong with the way you relate to me, you relate to each other. There's something profoundly wrong with the world. That's why I'm bringing these moments of suffering in part to actually wake you up. It's God's megaphone, come back. Because if you don't come back, what's happened there will happen to you as a certainty. You will perish. God uses these things to wake us up and call us back. Now, this doesn't answer everything about why suffering. It freaks people out to hear this, but the answer to suffering is not simply sin and judgment. There's much, much more going on as well. That's the foreground. That's the important, yes. But Job, the book of Job, tells you it wasn't sin and judgment in Job's life. It was something else entirely. We're told what it was, and it wasn't sin and judgment. Don't think that's the answer. And if you've got that, that's the end. No, there's much more complex going on. God's glory is part of it. There's a whole. We don't actually know all the answers. What we do know is it's not because God values human freedom so much. There's another little misstep that we take, which is that why suffering? Well, because God's let us have our freedom so that we can love him freely. And if he made us do good all the time, then we wouldn't freely love him. And that's why suffering, because free creatures are going to choose evil. And no, that's not the answer. It doesn't make sense of it all. God is sovereign over even my freedom. He can work sovereignly to cause me to will and act the way I will and act without intruding on my freedom. It's a misstep to think that's the conclusion. The Bible won't allow that. And it's important the Bible won't allow that, because if that's the case, if God has led us up to our freedom, which is why evil happens, and he's not in it, then that's not a God you can trust. That's not a God you can know is powerful enough to protect when he needs to protect. No, that's not the answer. The foreground is sin and judgment, but there's much more going on, and we don't know all the particulars about what that particular suffering's about. And so we're still left with questions. I'm still left having to say to you, I don't know all the answers. And so we come to the very last point, the most important point. So if you've drifted at all, and I know you haven't, I know you're engaged, but I just want to call you back because this is critical to get hold of. The thing that makes all the difference in the midst of a context where we don't know all the answers and we're fallible and need to bring humility to it, you know, why did God create it anyway? Why did he take us? We don't have all those answers. But there's something we can know. There's something profound and important that we can know with a certainty. That the all-powerful God who rules all things is truly, deeply, really all-loving. He is good and can be trusted when you don't have the answers. How do we know he's good? He's given the most astonishing and mind-blowing evidence of his goodness, his love. He's demonstrated his love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. That verse from the scriptures, from the book of Romans, captures so much in it. What it tells you is that God so loved us that he came into our world. He was born as one of us. He entered into our suffering with us. He wasn't aloof away from it. He entered into it with us. He walked through the pain and suffering that we endure. He allowed himself to be abused and beaten and tortured to then give his life on a cross, dying the most horrendous death devised by humanity. He entered into that. He's been where we've been. But he did all of that for a purpose. He did it to die in our place, to save us. He did it so that we might be rescued from suffering and judgment. Rescued to live in a world where there won't be any of that anymore. Such is God's love for us. And he did this in history so that you could know exactly what happened with all the evidences around it, so that you could know as a matter of certainty that God does love us. He's a God you can trust. You know, let me give a kind of a vivid expression of this in a reading that I read 35 years ago. This is a book I've had for a very long time. Let me read this to you. I've struggled each time I've read this, so we'll see how we go tonight. At the end of time, billions of people were scattered on a great plain before God's throne. Most shrank back from the brilliant light before them, but some groups near the front talked heatedly, not with cringing shame, but with belligerence. "Can God judge us? How can he know about suffering?" snapped a pert young brunette. She ripped open a sleeve to reveal a tattooed number from a Nazi concentration camp. "We endured terror, beatings, torture, death." In another group, a Negro boy lowered his collar. "What about this?" he demanded, showing an ugly rope burn. "Lynched for no reason but for being black." In another crowd, a pregnant schoolgirl with sullen eyes. "Why should I suffer?" she murmured. "It wasn't my fault." Far out across the plain were hundreds of such groups. Each had a complaint against God for the evil and suffering he had permitted in his world, including Stephen Fry. How lucky God was to live in heaven where all was sweetness and light, where there was no weeping or fear, no hunger or hatred. What did God know of all that men had been forced to endure in this world? "For God leads a sheltered life," they said. So each of these groups sent forth their leader, chosen because he had suffered the most, a Jew, a Negro, a person from Hiroshima, a horribly deformed arthritic, a thalidomide child. In the center of the plain, they consulted with each other. At last, they were ready to present their case. It was rather clever. Before God could be qualified to be their judge, he must endure what they had endured. Their decision was that God should be sentenced to live on earth as a man. Let him be born a Jew. Let the legitimacy of his birth be doubted. Give him a work so difficult that even his family will think him out of his mind when he tries to do it. Let him be betrayed by his closest friends. Let him face false charges, be tried by a prejudiced jury and convicted by a cowardly judge. Let him be tortured. At the last, let him see what it means to be terribly alone. Then let him die. Let him die so there can be no doubt that he died. Let there be a great host of witnesses to verify it. As each leader announced his portion of the sentence, loud murmurs of approval went up from the throng of people before God. When the last had finished pronouncing sentence, there was a long silence. No one uttered another word. No one moved. Because suddenly, all knew,
God had already served his sentence. God never stayed aloof from us. He's not that God. The Bible introduces to us to the real God, a God of power and might, who is far above us. Be humble before him. But a God of love, who can be trusted and has proved his love by entering into our world and dying the most gruesome death because he loved you so much. How dare anyone speak to God like Stephen Fry does? That God has demonstrated himself to be one that you can trust, who must have a good reason for what is happening. We don't know what it is. But neither should we have to. And neither should God have to defend himself. You know, if you're here tonight as someone who is wrestling with these things, suffering is real. There's much we can't know, but there's no worldview or religion that has the answers. The Christian faith does give some answers and leave some questions, but it does something that no other worldview or religion does. It shows us for who we are, gives us some actually hugely appropriate answers to the world we're in, and it tells us one more thing that you'll hear nowhere else, that the God who is sovereign, that you must bow the knee to, is a God of infinite love who can be trusted, who may not have told us all the reasons, but you can believe he's doing it for good. There must be a good reason. How do we respond? Humble ourselves and trust him. Turn back now. Were they worse sinners? No, you're just as bad. It's astonishing you get another night. You may not. Come back now to the God who will forgive you and bring you into eternity where there will be no more suffering, who will make all things right. Because of his love for you, he has paid for you with his son's blood. Come back and be forgiven. Those of you who do know Jesus, when you do go through suffering, don't fall into the trap of thinking you can work out the answer to why this particular piece of suffering is happening. John 8 tells you you can't do that. Various passages. Job tells you you can't do that. The thing you're called on to do is trust the goodness of God in the midst of it, that he must have some reason, though he hasn't told us. Let me pause there.
Throw some questions at you.
Yeah.
Okay, first one. So does God have a direct hand in suffering, or is it more like he allows suffering?
Yeah, these are going to be good questions. The scriptures wrestle both ways with us in this. Let me give you the kind of synthesized answer. God stands behind all things as the sovereign God of everything. But he stands behind evil in a different way than the way he stands behind good. He stands behind good directly. He stands behind evil in a different way that we don't quite understand, but he stands behind it, is sovereign over it, without being the author of it. James chapter 1 tells you that. But Isaiah 45 tells you that he actually brings all things. So does he just permit it, or does he will it? The language gets tricky at that point, but you know he's sovereign over it. Yeah.
Next one. How can I be so sure that the Bible gives me, in capitals, the best life, or the best things in life? I have a great life now. How does the Bible make my life any better?
Yeah, gee, this is a good process. The Bible does not say that if you come to Jesus, you'll have a life of health, wealth, prosperity. This is not, the church is not Mingara. Though we look like it is. The church is, you know, life's great, the slogan for Mingara. That's not church. The slogan for church is not, come to Jesus and your life will be great. No. The call of the scriptures is, come to God, he is your Lord. Come to him to acknowledge the truth. Come to him because your desperate need is to be rescued from death and judgment in hell. Whatever that brings in this life,
come to him because of those things. And for many people, it will bring persecution and suffering, death. But Jesus says, don't fear him who can kill the body. Fear him who can kill the body and after that cast your soul into hell. That's the one you should fear. There are more terrible things than losing your life. You come to Jesus, there's no guarantee you'll be healthy or wealthy. You'll get the girl, the boy, the career, the holiday. There's no guarantee at all. But you'll know the God of the universe. And you'll be forgiven. And you'll have a hope of eternity. So that our present sufferings will count for nothing in comparison to the glory yet to be revealed. This is not Mingara. This is a very different thing, yeah.
Just before I jumped up, you're talking about humbling yourself and trusting him. This question, I'll read it as it's come in. I'll leave you with this one. How are Christians needing humility and not getting a clear answer to the question of suffering any different to Muslims submitting to God?
Yeah, good. How are Christians needing to trust God any different to Muslims submitting to God? And in fact, just to reinforce that, how is what God says to Job any different to the Muslim claims God's saying to them, here I am, God, submit? I'll tell you the difference. It's the difference between submitting to a power and trusting a father. Wow. That's a world of difference. The fatherhood of God you do not find in Islam, but it's riddled through the scriptures. And the glory of the gospel message is that God sends his son that we might be forgiven and adopted to be his sons and daughters as well. Cherished by God the Father, loved by him, united with Christ, with all the privileges and pleasures and joys of life with the Father, with Jesus. That is found nowhere in the history of religions. It's an astonishing thing. It's tender. It's compassionate. It's loving. Now, Job tells you, and Philippians 2 tells you, that all humanity one day will be forced to submit. Everyone one day will have to bow the knee and be crushed because we're not God, and one day that will be apparent. But for just a moment, just this period of time in history, God gives this time of amnesty and says, there's a period here where before I will crush with power, you have an opportunity to be forgiven and come to know me as Father. Come now. Come now. Don't live drifting, because you will stand before the living God. You will have to bow the knee, and it will not go well unless you're covered by the merits and blood and grace of Jesus. But why wouldn't you come? Why wouldn't you come to find the fatherhood of God, the purpose for life, the reason for being, a hope for the future? How about I pray? Our great God, we do thank you for the astonishing news of the message of the gospel. We pray, please, that you would help it shape and control and influence our life. I pray for those amongst us who are maybe still wrestling with these things, that please you would work in their hearts, soften them, draw them to yourself. Help us be woken up by the reality of suffering to ourselves and our need of you. Help us as those who do know you, please, to live in confidence in you. And we ask it in Jesus' name.